You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Ahead on today's programme...
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. I am proud to be here to endorse Donald Trump for President of the United States.
The race before the real race for the White House gets real. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie announces his support for Donald Trump, while the first prominent Republican says he will not back the forerunner for the nomination. All this before tomorrow's Super Tuesday in the US. We'll discuss this with my guests, Raffaello Pantucci and Jonathan Fenby, as well as the day's other top stories, including the shaky ceasefire in Syria, now in its third day, and what we've learned so far about how well the US and Russia are able to cooperate. Elections in Iran, where moderates win a majority at the expense of hardliners, and the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, who reportedly is now going to share his wisdom with our own Labour Party here in the UK. Discussion of all that to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now managing director of the China team at Trusted Sources, and Raffaello Pantucci, director of international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. We start by looking at the shaky ceasefire in Syria. It's now in its third day, and at least according to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, it's holding by and large. However, sporadic fightings continued across the country, and there are growing claims from various sides of violations that threaten to derail it. At the same time, the UN has taken advantage of the truce, which was brokered by the US and Russia, by stepping up deliveries of vital food, water and medicines. Raffaello, maybe if I start with you, it's quite interesting that this seems to be, as fragile as it may well be, of course, an example of, you know, the US and Russia managing to work together to move something forward positively, in a however small a way it may be in the bigger picture. Have we learned anything more about how those countries, those two countries in particular, can cooperate in this theatre?
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, in some ways, the two have a similar sort of goal in mind when they're looking at Syria, in terms of they would like the conflict there resolved in some sort of a way. They have differences of opinion about who comes out on top in the end. But I think fundamentally, they want the sort of conflict there to end. The Russians don't want to get stuck in some interminable conflict, and the Americans don't want to get involved in some interminable conflict. So in many ways, I think the fact that we're seeing some sort of confluence in this view, resulting in a sort of willingness to have a diplomatic broker discussions in US and Russia, is not entirely surprising. In some ways, it feels like kind of short-term responsiveness. I think what worries me in some ways is that we still haven't addressed some of the fundamental questions here about what is the end state we're actually going to work towards, what is the role of groups like Ahrar al-Sham or the Nusra Front, which are or Daesh even, or ISIL, you know, which are groups that control a substantial piece of territory on the ground and, you know, will need to be brought into some sort of a discussion at the end of the day. So, you know, I can see that the ceasefire or the cessation of hostilities, I think it's been called, is a positive thing. I can understand why the US and Russia are working on it together. But I don't know if this is addressing the long-term kind of issues around Syria and what actually we're looking towards in the end.
Jonathan, I guess this is one of those examples where there's such a quagmire, it's of complexity, of conflicting interests. Is it even sensible to try and ask those big questions, though, or at this stage? Is it a mere cessation, even if it lasts just days or weeks even, something that we should be holding on to?
Well, I suppose a bit of sticking plaster like this does its good, obviously, in humanitarian way, above all. But as we were just hearing, really, this doesn't address any of the basic problems. You know, is Assad going to stay or is Assad not going to stay? And that underlies the whole thing. And Russia is not going to go along with any solution, which includes getting rid of Assad, who its baseline is to keep him in power in one form or other. Now, that may take different forms. But I think it depends largely on the situation on the ground. And the Russians have shown so far that they're going to push their man and their position on the ground as far as they wish.
Raf, it was interesting that you mentioned some of these other players in this, you know, whether it's the Al-Nusra Front or Islamic State or Daesh, call them what you will. And it does seem that everyone's been very explicit about their continued intention to very aggressively target these players. Mm. Is there a concern that, as well as not addressing the big picture, which you've mentioned, it could provide a pretext for some of the different sides here to continue their broader campaigns, whether it's, you know, the Russians, as Jonathan says, supporting Assad by attacking, you know, more moderate rebels and so on and so forth?
Well, I mean, clearly, yes. I mean, I think we saw when the truce was first announced, or cessation of hostilities, whatever you want to call it, one of the first things that happened was the leader of Al-Nusra Front, which is essentially Al-Qaeda on the ground in Syria, their leader, Mohammed al-Jawlani, put out a message in which he sort of rejected any such discussion, said this is completely, you know, negated and irrelevant to what's actually happening, and the jihad kind of goes on. And I think that's a reality that we still haven't really figured out how to confront, which is that, you know, you have got actors on the ground who are Al-Qaeda's representatives fighting there and who will continue to exist and continue to want to exert some sort of a force. But you've also got other groups which are somewhere in between, which we have different sort of views on, which Russia may perceive as a terrorist entity, whereas, you know, the West is actually actively supporting. There was an interesting thing the other day of, I think, one of a video emerged, which is the first one that emerged from Syria, of a American anti-tank weapon being used on a Russian tank. Now, we don't know if that was a Russian tank that was being manned by Russian soldiers or if it was by Syrian soldiers. But, you know, that, I think, shows a tension that does exist on the ground that we really haven't addressed. And this, you know, cessation of hostilities really does not address. And it is about, you know, what are we looking at in Syria now, and what is the ultimate Syria going to look like? I mean, I think the regime have in many ways written off a good part of the country. I think they're resigned to creating a sort of bigger Lebanon, if you will. But actually, that's quite worrying if you think about some of the actors who are on the ground, you know, and who therefore they're going to cede territory to. And are we saying, well, they, okay, by de facto, we're going to let Al-Qaeda's representative have a piece of territory on the ground? Are we going to let Daesh, ISIL, whatever, have their own territory on the ground? And what are we going to do about some of these groups in between, which are frankly very ideologically close to Al-Qaeda, but are not actually in that kind of a space? How do we deal with all these acts? And I don't see any sense of how to resolve these sorts of things and how to bring these people on board.
I mean, that's I guess the key point is bringing these people on board, Jonathan. What's the driver then? These are obviously incredibly complex questions. Mm. Where does that impetus come from? Is there even a singular authority who can do it? It seems not at the moment.
No,
the picture's so fragmented.
I don't think there is. I think the only driver is exhaustion or overwhelming force from one side or other. And of course, cessation of hostilities in these kind of situations can very often be a pause for everybody to restock their arms, to strengthen themselves, and then you have another go. And I didn't see any sign of any of the players voluntarily sitting down and saying, let's all be nice, reasonable folks, and carve up Syria between us. And Assad would find it difficult, I imagine, to admit that if he thinks that with the Russian help, he's still on the ascendant.
I just wonder, Raphael, when we talk about Syria and we talk about it as this fractured, you know, fragmented country, we basically describe it now as basically a basket case with all of these complexities that you've described. People, I think about it almost as if we're in unprecedented territories here. But, I mean, are there examples of countries that have been riven by similar kind of divides where some sort of coherence has emerged from the chaos? Is there anything that could give even the most optimistic person hope, do you think?
Well, I mean, I'd say look at Lebanon in many ways, you know, the neighboring country of Lebanon, which is a country that was racked by civil war for a very long period of time, and now has sort of developed into a state which has, you know, an organization that is a prescribed terrorist organization by the United States, and part of it is by the European Union as well. Hezbollah is controlling a major piece of territory there. And yet, the country is able to sort of function in some sort of way. I was lucky enough to go to Beirut about a month ago, and it's a lovely city. I'd highly recommend it. And it doesn't feel like a war zone. And so, you know, there is a way that one can see this going forwards. But, you know, it is the problem is that I think looking to the Lebanon model, which is the kind of most obvious one, which I would cast about, and I know maybe Jonathan has some others in mind. But the problem is Lebanon is quite small. And Syria is much bigger, and you're dealing with a very, very different set of equations. And when you're dealing with a group like Daesh, you're dealing with a very different kind of entity to Hezbollah, which in many ways was, you know, saw itself as a sort of vanguard movement that wasn't quite, I mean, it's similar but different. And so I think you are dealing with a very different situation on a much larger scale, which has wider ramifications across the sort of broader region.
And of course, you've got the great power involvement here, you know, the US and Russia. The US doesn't want to commit itself more in Syria, but it doesn't want Syria to become a Russian sphere of influence and so on. And equally, Russia is not going to pull out from that. So that's an added, I think, complication to it. And so you can't really point, for instance, at Yugoslavia as an example. I think it's quite different. And in Yugoslavia, there was a much clearer division between, say, Bosnia, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and so on, which was there historically. In this case, it's quite a new situation on the ground with these various warring groups. And with always, I mean, you were referring a few moments ago to an American having destroyed a Russian tank, always the possibility of some direct conflict, clash, accident between them. You've got Turkey involved with the Kurds. This is a very, very complex situation, and I just don't see any way out of it except sheer exhaustion.
A grim reading, but I fear maybe an accurate one. Let's move on and talk about the weekend's elections in Iran, which saw the country's moderates and liberals making significant gains. President Rouhani and his allies won 15 of 16 Tehran seats in the Assembly of Experts. That vote was held on the same day as the country's parliamentary elections, in which moderates and reformist candidates won all 30 of Tehran's seats. It's the first parliamentary vote since Iran signed a nuclear deal with world powers, of course. Rafael, I wonder what would you pick out as the key thing here? I mean, the Assembly of Experts, I guess we should remember, may well choose the next supreme leader. And often people say that could be the thing that drives an even more seismic shift for, well, that's a rather bad pun, than maybe some of the things we've already seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly in the Iranian system, the supreme leader is the ultimate, ruler of this domain, and he's the one who really can cast down these sorts of decisions. I mean, in some ways, it's, and that's what's going to have a long-term impact on the country. And, given the age of the current one, it's possible that this group will be likely choosing the next. So there is quite a lot of importance within that. I think what's interesting to me, and I try to follow Iran as much as I can, but I'm not sort of in the weeds of it, but colleagues of mine who are very much in the weeds of it tell me how surprising this was. The expectation was very much that this was a kind of a clean sweep with the conservatives, and that we were going to see a very hardening of the sort of conservative role and of their sort of domain. And we've already seen some evidence of how the friction between the conservatives and reformists does have ramifications on the international stage in terms of, for example, their proactive activity in places like Syria, which we were just talking about, or looking at sort of the negotiations around the deal, around the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and looking at sort of sanctions relief. There is a direct correlation between that. And I think the sense was that the conservatives are very much tightening their grip, and that was having a reflection in how the country was going forwards. What I don't know, and I think Iran watchers are still trying to figure out, is, well, what does it mean if the reformists are actually able to sweep in? What does that mean for this internal clash that we saw happening, which is causing all sorts of complications in every direction, if actually the people who were expected to lose come out on top? Will that mean that the conservatives roll over and sort of let this, democracy have its day and, everything moves forwards? Or will they react with even more sort of aggressive pushback on some of the reformist factions and their ability to sort of move and operate?
I mean, Jonathan, I guess that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's hard to look at this in these early stages, as Rafael identifies there. There's so many questions remaining, but it looks like, democratic, elections happening with people making their decisions based on their own political ideas and ideologies, and something quite maybe profoundly positive is happening. Is it just far too early to say that, or do you think we can welcome this with cautious optimism?
Well, it's always too early to say anything. But yes, I mean, I think, we were talking Syria, basket case, downside. Iran, definitely hopeful, I think. And I think what you've got here, I mean, as we were just hearing, there seems to have been a big push by the conservatives to Revolutionary Guards and others to affect the outcome of the election, which obviously didn't work. One has to, I think, assume from that there is a very strong current in Iranian society, which is for ending the purdah, re-establishing links with the rest of the world. I mean, it isn't necessarily directly the support for nuclear curbs. I mean, a lot of Iranians who are anti-regime are still want to have a nuclear power of some kind. It's a kind of nationalist thing, I think, there. But undoubtedly, there is this push, for what you would call in Chinese terms, the opening up of the country there. And On the hopeful side, I would think, I mean, there is so much economic upside for Iran in that opening up in all kinds of ways. I mean, both in opening up relationships with the West, China, obviously, which already Xi Jinping's already been to Tehran, and huge plans for infrastructure, of course, it being China, unveiled there, and that you could get this kind of mixture of the social push, an educated elite, which is going to continue and stick to its guns, this, the economic advantages coming through, and if necessary, you can use that to pay off the Revolutionary Guards and others making money out of the present system. And I think, you know, this is a cause for hope.
That's interesting. Is it that classic question, then, of the economic arguments being the most powerful? Because it's interesting, again, you bring in China and, of course, the huge investments that could flow from Beijing. We know what Iran could be for the region. It could be the Middle East powerhouse. Does economics prevail even over ideology? Is that what we're seeing?
I think it's very difficult to make a direct correlation. I think that what you can say is, I think that there was a level of anger, obviously, and disappointment with the conservative elements within Tehran, and obviously the body politic there has made the community has decided this is not the direction that we wanted to be going in. You know, and I think you've seen this before. You know, if you think back to Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran, who was this, you know, incredibly bellicose figure, you know, was running around the world, sticking his nose and his finger into the West's eyes and, you know, poking and going, this causing all this ruction. No, he got booted out. You know, he was actually a very populist leader. People really liked him because he lived in a sort of, not a pauper's home, but a, you know, very relatively common home, and you know, he sort of had this whole populist touch. But but at the end of the day, people finally got irritated by this sort of constant rage and this sort of things that he was pushing in the direction of that, and they got rid of, you know, he got pushed out of the way. And so, you know, I think that what we can see is that obviously the Iranian public does have a relatively short fuse for conservative elements who are not delivering on promises. So economics are clearly what ultimately determine people's decisions in many ways. I mean, you know, that's what impacts you in terms of your political decisions, how it impacts your sort of wallet. So, you know, maybe that's the direct link to make, but I would suspect that it's in fact a case of the Iranian public making a very conscious decision that, you know, the conservatives are not taking the country in the direction they wanted to. The reformers offer an opportunity and a chance which they want to take advantage of.
Is it slightly, Jonathan, one of these things where you almost have to wait, though, maybe one political generation? Because there's some suggestion that in some cases it was some conservatives have been successful. They were backed maybe even by some reformists who were more worried about keeping out real hardliners. Mm-hmm. When you've got that kind of political machination going on, it's maybe too much to hope that you can get sort of, you know, instant change, I suppose.
Not instant, but I think it could be fairly quick there, because all the reports from people who know about Iran is that there is this willingness, this readiness for, or desire, indeed, for change. I would think the big danger would be that the Conservatives, the Revolutionary Guard and others think, oh dear, you know, we're going to be done for if we go on with this democratization and process, and then you have the famous coup from the Conservatives to prevent, and then the whole thing either descends into bloody chaos, or the brakes are put on and it's all stopped there. Of course, there is the regional element in this, how far Iran goes on supporting its client movements elsewhere. I'm not sure that the moderates can really pull the plug on that at the moment. They'll have to be careful as to what, you know, what moves in what order and so on. But I think if we meet, say, not immediately, but in a year's time, we might well find that there has been considerable progress there.
There we go. That's an optimistic note. That's nice to strike.
Yes, I like occasionally. Normally.
Light and shade on Midori House. That's Jonathan Fenby and Raffaello Pantucci, who will both be with me when we come back just after this to hear about how the US is getting ready for Super Tuesday, and about how the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis seems to have found a new pastime somewhere here in the UK. Find out exactly where after this.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests today, Raffaello Pantucci and Jonathan Fenby. In the US, the remaining presidential candidates are gearing up for arguably the most important voting event of the pre-general election season, Super Tuesday. Voters head to the polls tomorrow to help select both the Democrat and Republican nominees. As many as 14 states take part. The recent days have served to emphasize divisions within the GOP. Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, has publicly endorsed Donald Trump, whereas others, the senator of Nebraska, Ben Sasse, for example, is one of the first relatively high-profile Republicans to announce that he will not back the front runner and will look for a third option if he ends up having to choose between Trump and Hillary later in the year. I think that's called Hobson's choice. Christie, Jonathan, was in the race before. He'd branded some of the most egregious Trumpisms idiotic and others. Now he's backing him. And I just wonder if you're sort of looking at, as a bit of a cynic at politics, should we be surprised that political expediency here has trumped, you know, well, for want of a better phrase, yeah, exactly. political instinct and principle.
Yeah, no, I don't think we should be surprised at all. I mean, the bookies today make Trump the favourite to get the Republican nomination. And I suppose, to be realistic or cynical, as you might put it, Christie hopes that he might get the vice presidential slot rather than Sarah Palin, who seems to have ruled herself out. And while I was being optimistic about Iran, I think, you know, this makes one more and more pessimistic about the nature of how democracy plays itself out in the most important democracy in the world. Because, you know, people talk about it's all money, politics, it's all corrupt and so on and so on. Well, we can live with that to an extent. But what Trump represents is really something that is, I think, just anarchy on a mega scale. And if not necessarily a majority of the voters, but a majority of one of the two main parties goes for that, we're in a situation probably of fragmentation among the Republicans. Open the door for Hillary to get in, which may or may not be a bad thing. You could think of that. And the best potential candidate, I think, Mike Bloomberg, will not run because, will be held back from running under this theory because of the fear that he will drain votes from the Democrats as an independent and open the door to the White House to Trump, which is, of course, the thing which seemed inconceivable 6 months ago or so, but now people are actually kind of
becoming
playing with the idea.
Strangely realistic doomsday
yes.
scenario.
I still don't believe it, but
we can all hope, Jonathan. I mean, Raffaello, what is most striking here is perhaps not these announcements by various people at different idiot fringes of the GOP or the Republican movement. But maybe is this wider point which Jonathan's making, which is that we're used to seeing people paying their way to, if not to high office, certainly to be competitive in the US. Mm. But we're maybe not used to seeing, I don't know, sort of intellectually bereft campaigns that just seem to roll on and on and on. I mean, how worried should the rest of the world almost be looking at what's happening in the US?
I mean, I think it's desperately depressing. And, you know, if we take the US as the kind of the Democratic example that everyone likes to follow, or ultimately everyone follows, well, that's a worrying trend that we're all heading towards. If we're all headed towards this sort of bizarre election with celebrity television stars, you know, suddenly coming out on top as legitimate candidates when they've, you know, expressed opinions that are frankly overt racism, xenophobia, you name it, you know, and also make no sense.
Yeah, well, that's
you know,
point,
and directly yeah. contradict yeah, each yeah, other as yeah. well. It's not just that we're dealing with xenophobia.
Why is it that there's not more reaction within the GOP? Is it just a personnel issue that, you know, you look at, say, Cruz and Rubio, they yeah. weren't able, even on the debating platform, to parry these pretty basic Trump maneuverings? Why is that happening?
Well, I think it's because, I mean, there's been some really good political writing in the States, you know, and some of it has pointed to the fact that I think that there is, I think it was Kagan or one of the Kagans did a very interesting op-ed somewhere, I think it was the Washington Post, in which they referred to the fact that, you know, well, this is what the GOP, it got what it deserved in many ways because they've been fostering this kind of you know, you look at the Tea Partiers beforehand who were equally sort of on the loony end of the scale. You know, this is something that the GOP has been fostering for some time, and this is kind of the natural end of that kind of story. If you're going to be the party that's just going to, you know, go into Congress and say, okay, we're not going to agree with anything the Democrats say, nothing, nothing. It doesn't matter what they say. We're going to disagree with it because you are the Democrats and we are the Republicans. Well, then you're kind of setting yourself up for this kind of a situation where you create a leader or a potential leader who frankly feeds that baser narrative, you know, and I think that this is what they've been feeding for some time and this is the end result of it. I also think that frankly, if you look at the other options and you look at Rubio in particular, I mean, this is just the latest in a long line of cookie cutter politicians who all kind of say empty things that sound very, that are kind of pandering and don't actually seem to be dealing with some of the important issues of our day. You know, it's a sort of classic populist politicians just winning votes and people becoming very cynical because they don't really see anything, politicians changing their lives in any meaningful way.
I think Trump, you refer to him as, you know, the leader, you choose a leader like this. He isn't really the leader of the Republicans. I mean, he may be the person they're going to back in the primaries and so on and so on. But he's essentially a non-party figure.
True.
Who's
the figurehead.
Who exactly. Becomes the figurehead, and thereby he actually weakens and, I wouldn't say destroys, but certainly seriously damages the party, which has allowed him to parachute himself on top of it, despite the fact, you know, a lot of it, you watch the reports, you know, we're going to build this wall against Mexico. Yes, we're going to build, shouts the crowd back. And who's going to pay for it? The Mexicans. Well, there is a basic question in something like that. What if the Mexicans don't want to pay for a wall to cut themselves off? You know, there is no logic or reality.
But he never seems to be derailed when these
No, but it's pure emotion. It's pure emotion, I think. It's pure emotion.
But I think it speaks to the huge disconnect that there is between the public base and the party itself. It's just the party obviously doesn't have any idea what its base really wants. I think the Tea Party was the first expression of that. Sort of Trump is the next natural sort of evolution of this sort of a thing.
Fears what the third step in that.
Well, exactly.
Who knows? Maybe they won't still be around for us to find out. Let's talk just finally about another political figure here in the UK. Well, from Greece, Yanis Varoufakis. Everyone will, I'm sure, remember the Greek finance minister who took Greece to the brink of a eurozone exit by battling creditors over the bailout conditions. He's got a new role advising the British Labour Party. A spokesman for the Labour Party here says Varoufakis will take part in a lecture series to discuss his experiences and offer advice on Labour policy in an attempt to raise the level of public debate on economics and policy making. What do you make of that, Jonathan? Is that how politics should function better, or does anything about that worry you to a degree?
I'd be quite sceptical about this. I mean, one falls for the cliche immediately, you know, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. And I think the problem with this is, A, his record in Greece was hardly impressive when you saw it didn't work.
It worked for him personally.
It worked for him personally, but right. it didn't work for the policies, and it didn't work for the government he was meant to be part of. So there's a shambles there. He comes here, which may be very nice for him. He'll ride his motorbike around London and so on and so on, etc. But the problem, I think, with this is, without sounding too much of a boring austerity economist, is that this adds to the perception in Britain that Corbyn and John McDonnell, the Treasury man for the Labour Party, belong somewhere on an unrealistic left of politics. And this increases the real danger, not both for the Labour Party and I think for the way British politics works, that we've got a government, a Tory party, with a small majority in Parliament, but which really doesn't have to worry now because the opposition is painting itself out of the picture, as perhaps Trump is painting the Republicans out of the picture.
Well, are there comparisons here, Raffaello, just briefly, with this idea of, you know, a political party or a movement or personnel who are disconnected from their base or from some of the things that concern their base? Or are they worried about a different part of the base to whom they're addressing everything and missing out on what the broader population, who may or not be party affiliates, right, actually want?
Well, they're speaking to a very narrow base. I think in both cases, they're speaking to a very narrow base, and that narrow base will show up and shout at rallies and be very public and whatever, but come voting day, they will be a percentile of the population, not a majority. So you're frankly dealing with unelectable entities. You know, and I think this choice by Corbyn to go in this direction, you know, and also, I'm sorry, bringing a Greek finance minister on board here when the UK is having this sort of evanescent conversation about what we're going to do within Europe, is I just don't see the sort of connection with reality that we're getting out of this, you know, and I don't see how this is somehow going to make Corbyn or Labour any more electable. And it's fascinating because if you look on the papers over the weekend, it's all been about the Tories sort of turning in on each other and fighting out. But you know what? They can get away with that because there's no one on the other side. So there we go.
Yeah, it's another gift to the Tories.
Exactly.
I mean, this is the worrying thing, that the people running the Labour Party at the top and their advisers seem to be intent on going their own furrow, largely ideological, with their friends and so on, and regardless of the electorate.
There we must leave it. Yep. Big questions posed, as always, and most of them answered, I would say, by Jonathan Fenby and Raffaello Pantucci. Gentlemen, thanks both for being with us on Midori House. Today, it's all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Giusti, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We will be hearing music from Carlotta Ribello up next, 1900s Culture with Robert Bound, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Join us again. This show's back 1800 hours London time tomorrow. Goodbye.